Welcome to the Why Podcast. I'm Greg Williams, and today we're going to do something slightly different. It's a new type of podcast from Wired where we talk about our fantastic feature content. Wired sends writers all over the world to meet people doing extraordinary things and tell incredible, award-winning stories. And we thought we'd like to offer you, the reader, a little bit more about these fascinating reports, give you further insights about the subject matter, and perhaps draw the curtain back and tell you a little bit about how we put together our stories. Please note, this will not be replacing the wired.co.uk weekly podcast. It's going to be a complement to it. There will be no Biggie versus Tupac beefing. This is more like ham and mustard, or Uber and controversy. They will complement each other perfectly. Our first guest is Michael Hodges, the writer of the cover story from our April issue, which is on newsstand and online at this very moment.
Hello, Greg.
Hello, sir. So I should just explain, Michael is a long-time contributor to Wired and has written, among many other things, a fantastic sort of social history of the AK-47. Would you describe it in that way?
Yes, that's what it is. It's the People's History of the Gun was his subtitle.
So, Michael, for the cover story for the April issue, you travelled to Korea, South Korea, with the New York-based Human Rights Foundation to meet members of the defector community, people who've crossed the border from North Korea. They're now involved in an initiative that unites the activists in Korea with technologists and campaigners in the West. Can you just kind of talk a little bit, give us a broad sense of what the story's about?
Well, the Human Rights Foundation in itself, you know, it is a pressure group advocating and seeking change, and it helps bring about change by, in essence, bringing attention to the people that are actually doing it. So the trip to South Korea for them was to bring publicity, attention, and a morale booster to the defector groups, people who have got out of North Korea, who are now campaigning and have been for a long time to bring about change in the North. And I guess it was about turning up the volume on those efforts and really reigniting something that fades from our consciousness in the West quite often.
But sure.
It's important to remember that this is a battle that's 5-6 decades over.
Sure. Nowadays they're using technology, right? They're using technology in order to get information. I mean, North Korea obviously is a completely, it's a hermit state. Information really, we don't get much information out of it. It's very hard to get information into it. So how are they using technology in order to get information into the country?
You know, to answer the question about the effect of new technology in its role in bringing about change in North Korea, I think it's important perhaps to establish first that although North Korea is called the Hermit Kingdom, it's locked itself away. I think we all know the idea of anywhere being impervious to the onward march of technological innovation is not possible. So, you know, technology gets into North Korea. And they try and control it. They have their own closed intranet, for want of a better expression, that you know, party officials, people of influence, you know, those you would expect to have access to, do have access to. They also have Secret Service operatives who spend all day on the internet.
Yeah.
You know, the very top leadership looks at the internet. They are very aware that there is a cyber world that affects them. And as we've seen of late, they enter into that cyber world and quite audaciously and will attack people, the Sunny Hack being the case in point. So North Korea is a state where new technology is known about and used. Ordinary people obviously don't have access to it. So hacker groups are well aware that an ordinary North Korean can't just log on to the internet and see the truth about the free world.
Right. So they're using what kind of things in order to get the information in? Presumably it's USBs, it's leaflet drops, which you describe in the story.
I think that the game changer, as you would say, for getting information into North Korea is the USB.
Yeah.
I mean, they're pretty tough. They're tiny. You can drop them from balloons. You can hide them up your whatever if you want to get them across a border control. You can sling them by rubber catapult, which some people are doing, across one of the two rivers that that border North Korea and China, which is the main smuggling route. Essentially, USB is of great use because increasingly the North Koreans have benefited from the manufacturing revolution in China. There are lots of cheap DVD players from China in North Korea, and these come with a USB plug point in them, with a socket for USB.
So they pick these USBs up, they put them into their devices, whatever those are. Mm. Do you get a sense, do we know what kind of punishments there are if you're caught with a USB, or if you're caught talking about the information that you've consumed because of having one of these USBs?
The punishment you receive for viewing banned material depends to a degree on what the material is and whether you are evangelical about it. So, for instance, in any propaganda war, people want to be entertained, don't they? You know, really, the defectors are sending across South Korean soap operas, Western movies. The political message is subtle and locked within the entertainment. Life here is great fun.
Yes.
You know, and it's quite normal to have food in the fridge.
Yes.
It's actually quite normal to have a fridge, which in themselves are pretty revolutionary messages in North Korea. But also, there's USBs with the entire, which is full of, you know, what we could call the truth about the North Korean political system and North Korea's history. I mean, most North Koreans believe that the Korean War was started by the South and by the imperialist Yankees, whereas in fact the North invaded the South. If you are caught watching South Korean soap movies, you will be in a lot of trouble. You will be going to a labour camp to be re-educated, which can be in itself a death sentence. They are incredibly harsh places. But if you are caught spreading the word about what you've seen, inviting people into your house to watch this movie, or indeed inviting people into your house to enjoy the downloaded history of the Korean War, then you still can be, and people often are, you shot. It will be a public execution, you know, to discourage the others.
So is there any sense of conflict amongst the defectors that they're sending this material in? Presumably that means that people could end up in all kinds of, you know, very unpleasant situations because of this material. Is there a sense from them that there's a greater good by sending the material in, and only by winning this culture war can we actually affect change? Or do they have, you know, conflicted emotions about it?
I think that's the key question. And you know, when I was there for Wired, it really struck me that technology innovation is not a moral-free zone. There's not many bigger moral choices than, will this action of mine, sending in a USB, lead to someone's death? Or I asked the people from the Human Rights Foundation, and they're very bullish. Their argument is, you know, let freedom prevail. Send the ideas in and let the North Koreans deal with it. Freedom is a tough place to be, would be their argument, and it carries risks, but they're worth it. If you're actually a defector who's perhaps lost family, who knows the reality of your relatives being shot, of your mother starving to death, it's a very tough question. And I asked it, and one defector said to me, if we all worried about our families being shot or other people suffering because they saw our material, then nothing would ever happen. There would be no change.
Sure. So it's basically the idea that it's the greater good. If doing this will affect change in some way, and it's better than doing nothing at all.
But it's a very tough choice, and they take it. But it's a very tough. They made it clear to Wired that they consider the implications before they do it, but they still do it. It's worth it. Yeah.
So you actually witnessed one of these famous balloon drops. Now, from what I understand, they happen in the demilitarized zone, which is, what, only about 50 kilometers north of Seoul. You went in the dead of night. What did you see? Who was there? What was going on? What kind of material were they getting across? It must have been kind of a very dramatic experience.
About a bit like a conflict zone, actually, the boredom followed by extreme excitement. There was a coach trip from Seoul up to the DMZ, which is about 50 kilometers, and the DMZ itself is maybe 4 or 5 kilometers wide. So you're very close to North Korea, the strangest, most other place in the world
that
you can imagine if you come from a Western democracy. So that in itself is in your mind. It's very dark, it's very cold. The team you're with are conscious not only that the North Koreans have opened fire from the other side before.
That happened in October last year, was it? There was artillery
rounds were fired from the north into the south, which makes, if you have a farm in the south, you're not that pleased to see a group of defectors turn up. So plus there are for want of a better expression, left-wing elements in South Korean society who are against the balloon launches, who believe in a different kind of dialogue, who see the American military presence as the primary problem. Plus, there is just the police will often turn up because the South Korean government has its own avenues and channels of negotiation with the North. It's a very delicate business, as we all know. It threatens to break out into war regularly. And so they don't want these balloons, which enrage the North Koreans, going over the DMZ. So all these things are going through your mind. Plus, it's very, very cold. It's night. They've got five sausage-shaped long balloons, which they fill with hydrogen gas, which just adds an element of danger because, of course, it's highly explosive. The advantage is once they let go of them, they shoot up to 10,000 feet, and then prevailing winds at that level take them across the border into North Korea.
The winds are always prevailing in that direction.
Not always, but you know,
they planned it. They know what they're doing.
They know what they're doing.
So you've got these long sausage-shaped balloons, and there's a basket or something attached full of USBs and material.
It's very loud. The machine on the back of a pickup truck which pumps the hydrogen into balloons makes a very loud noise, which all adds to the sense of rush and kind of frantic atmosphere around the launch. And of course, no, you can't smoke, and Koreans like to smoke because it's hydrogen, so there's also the risk the thing will blow up, you know, which was only fully explained to me halfway through. I stepped back the 4 feet that would save my life if a balloon went off. Yeah, and underneath this is essentially a large plastic bag, about the size of a very large bin liner. It's full of USBs, full of leaflets. Quite often they'll send currency, dollars, just to get them in the habit of dollars. Dollars equals democracy in their worldview. And also it makes a big difference to people's lives. And also, it makes people rush to get the bags. It's a slight bribe. You know, if you know there's some dollars in there, you would go and find it. And a secondary effect, hopefully, is the material also gets distributed.
And they were distributing, when you were there, they were distributing copies of The Interview, the movie that, you know, caused such problems last November with the...
When I was there, they were sending up publicity material drawing people's attention to The Interview. This is the film to look out for.
I hope Seth Rogen gets some kind of back end for that. You know, make sure the royalties are all served up to.
The royalties were an issue. Actually, that's why they didn't go over during Wired's visit, because there were some copyright issues. Though I'm not sure the studios would sue over potential sales in North Korea. But they will be doing it. USBs with The Interview on will be going in these plastic bags underneath the balloons, which have an acid fuse on. So it's quite simple technology, the timer. And once the acid burns through, the package is released and the USBs and the dollars and the leaflets come tumbling down.
I know you met a number of different defectors while you were out there. Each of them obviously has a very, you know, unique and powerful story to tell. There's this great moment at the beginning of the story where you admit that it's very hard actually listening to some of the stories because they're so powerful and frankly upsetting. Which story kind of left its mark on you? Obviously, they're all important, but which one kind of did you, at the moment, you just thought, wow, this is something that this is a story we need to tell. We need to get this out there.
You're right. There's all of the stories were, I mean, I've travelled the world. I've been to conflict zones. I've met people who have lost everything. I'm used to meeting people who have had tough lives. But when you meet North Korean defectors, you step back, you're astounded by what they've come through. And not only come through it, but maintain their dignity and their self-respect and their drive. And one of the things that really hit me was the amount of young people, young women especially, who had come through remarkable experiences. I mean, there's one lady in her early 30s, Hyun-so Lee, who had seen, you know, she lived with the prospect of never seeing her family again. She'd been forced as a child to witness public executions. She'd followed an immensely difficult trail once she'd crossed the border into China to get to South Korea, because for a lot of people, things actually get slightly worse once they get into China. There's all sorts of dangers there for them.
The Chinese authorities sometimes return people who've managed to get across the border, is that true?
Yeah, the different elements in the Chinese border police will send escapers back. and also they can be bribed. It happens, but they are you have to be quite unlucky to be caught. It's a very long border with only so many Chinese border guards on it. But yes, many defectors have been caught and sent back. And also, it's not just enough to get through the border, the immediate border region. You can be picked up in the cities further into China. You know, they actively look for defectors because, you know, North Korea has been one of their main allies with which they have treaties and agreements. But of course, the ferocity of the Chinese authorities ebbs and flows with how China feels about North Korea at any given moment.
Right.
At the moment, you know, China could do without North Korea's behaviour, that there's a certain amount of exasperation. And so accordingly, the Chinese will slacken up a little bit. They'll be less helpful to the North Koreans.
Sure. And you were talking about the experience of this young woman. She managed to get across the border, and then that was almost kind of the beginning of the difficulties that she faced.
Yes. Yeah, so then she then had to get her mother and her sister on a 2,000-mile trail down through China, down to Indochina, past various policemen, border controls, hardly any money, all sorts of scrapes, desperation. And then in Laos, her mother was arrested, her mother and sister, and it looked like they were going to be repatriated. And she found an Australian backpacker who just gave her the money to bribe the officials to get her mother and sister out. So she went for this immense experience. The escape in itself was astounding, but on top of that, she'd been through the misery of a childhood in North Korea. So when you meet a defector, you're meeting someone who has had an extraordinary life. The very fact they are sat there talking to you means they are not like ordinary people.
Yeah, and that's a kind of a point I'm interested in touching on. One of the people I know you met was Yang Yin-sung, who wrote one of the best-known books by a defector. He's talked about how the regime, it's not just about imprisoning people by force, that there's this kind of emotional dictatorship going on in North Korea. That must be a hard thing for people to break away from as well.
I asked most of the North Korean defectors I met, and they get he in particular got quite offended when I asked if you know, the great leader who's drilled into you from childhood is your father, who's the person you love amongst all others, if the great leader was still in his heart or mind. And he got quite cross and said, no, I've got him out.
Yeah.
But Yomni Park, another young female defector, I was talking to her. She said sometimes she still hears the songs, you know, dear leader, you are the only one for us. We, you know, we love you. We dedicate our hearts to you. And she still feels the emotional pull. It's a system where they take you as a child and convince you that the system is your mother and father. That's the emotional hold. That's the, yeah, the level of the dictatorship. It's in your very essence.
So there's no escaping it at any time of the day or night. You're fully surrounded by it. So how effective do you think these groups are? Are they an annoyance, an irritation to the north, to the authorities in the north, or are they really affecting positive change that's kind of tangible?
It's hard to judge how effective defector groups' campaigns are because it's pretty hard to do any research in North Korea. There, when people get out across the Chinese border, different groups are really making an effort not only to help them to get them to South Korea, but to interview them at length. And most people that come out say, yes, we encountered material from the South, and yes, it's changed our perspective, and it is it's having an effect on society. But, you know, the North Korean government isn't stupid. It knows it can't stop the tide, but it can redirect the water. So it allows a certain amount of latitude. It's not as bad as it was arguably 10 years ago, simply because it has to survive, it has to change to some degree. So there is an acknowledgement that people will be seeing a certain amount of South Korean soap operas, that kids will listen to K-pop. It's not encouraged, but they know it's there, and in so doing hope to control it. What will bring the system down is, yes, it's gradual social change, as happened in East Germany.
Yeah.
But the little things, you know, the price of bread, why can't I buy a single by this band? You know,
people wanting to buy jeans, people wanting to have Walkmans. I always remember it was the excitement they used in the Soviet Union.
So you're right, these things build gradually and create an unstoppable force eventually. But I mean, some defectors I spoke to said actually real change comes when there is an elite, and quite often they work in technical jobs. They will be the people perhaps involved in the hacking brigade.
Yeah.
maybe two Korean intellectuals and computer engineers who at the moment are dedicated to causing problems in the West, but essentially they're living in the West. Their asses may be parked in Pyongyang, but their minds are over here. And you turn them eventually and you have a core that's ready to reject the system. So I think there's a campaign for gradual social change amongst the masses. But for that tipping point is when the new generation of clued up, engaged, internet-using, middle-ranking North Korean party officials come over.
Great. Well, let's hope that continues to happen. Michael, thanks so much for joining us. Really terrific to have you here this morning, and thanks so much for doing such a great report. If you haven't read Michael's report from North Korea yet, I suggest you stop what you're doing, read it immediately. It's a great piece of work. We'll be back with another Wired podcast about our feature material in the next couple of weeks. In the meantime, you're going to have to console yourself with the wired.co.uk podcast every Thursday. I'm Greg Williams. Thanks for listening, and have a great week.